And good morning and welcome to Writers on Writing on 88.9 KUCI FM. We are broadcasting from the University of California, Irvine campus and on the web at KUCI.org and at iTunes on College Radio. Today is Wednesday, January 11th, 2012. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett. And in case some of you have been trying to tune into the podcasts, take heart. We're working out the problem, and hopefully it'll be worked out soon. Just technical glitches. What more can I say? My guests today are Leonda Lynn Hout and Kelly Sonnek. We're going to start with Leonda Lynn Hout. I want to read to you, before we bring her on, I want to read to you a little piece from a Los Angeles Times review of her book, Crow Planet, Essential Wisdom from the Urban Wilderness, that was published, it's been a little while, a year ago, maybe a little more than that. Let me see when this review was. The review was August 30th, 2009, so it's been more than a year ago, but it just came out in paperback, and in the review is what made me aware of Leonda's book, and she was on when it came out in hardback, and I'm bringing her back because the podcasts are so messed up, and I really want all of you to be aware of this book and of the important work she's doing. But the reviewer says, in a lyrical narrative that blends science and conscience, Hout mourns the encroachments of urbanization but cherishes the wildness that survives. And let's bring her on to talk about Crow Planet. Hi, Leonda.
Hi, Barbara.
Great to have you back. As I said in the intro, I wanted to have you back on the show for a few reasons. One is because Crow Planet is now in paperback, and another is that our podcasts are messed up and inaccessible for the most part, and because I started reading your book again, I wanted to talk to you again and make sure that our listeners who may not have heard the show when it was originally on, when it was originally broadcast, become aware of your paperback, learn about you and your work, and the wonderful Crow Planet. And you also demystify crows, which I appreciate quite a bit because I like crows. And whenever I see them on the street or doing something, I'm always singing their praises, and whoever I'm with looks at me like, huh? What are you talking about? So talk about how you came to appreciate crows and write Crow Planet.
Right. Well, thanks again, Barbara, for having me on. I'm glad to be back on the show, and I'm sorry about your technical difficulties. I have them myself now and then. One of the things that I say in my book many times is that crows are not my favorite bird. You know, a lot of times people will just glance at the book and say, oh, you know, she's a lover of crows, and that's what this book is about. And it's really not. It's kind of a more of a sidelong approach to crows. In fact, in my first book, Rare Encounters with Ordinary Birds, crows weren't even included. And the editor asked me to write about them, and I said, well, you know, I've already written a chapter about starlings, and that's another, you know, dark, ubiquitous urban bird, and I don't really think I need to write another one. And he said, no, yeah, we're going to have crows in the book as well. So, so I thought, well, gosh, I have to come up with something pretty quick. And so I started interviewing just people that I knew and people that seemed like they might have something to say about birds, about what they thought about crows. And these aren't, you know, ornithologists or scientists, but just kind of everyday people that live in urban landscapes and encounter birds regularly. And I have honestly never been so surprised about a reaction to a bird, because if you talk to someone about chickadees or robins, you know, the response is, you know, cute, nice, pretty, what is there really to say about these pleasant birds that surround us? But if you bring up crows, as you say, when you, you know, point crows out, the reaction is very strong. People either love them. Crows are one of those birds that people take as their special totem bird, a bird that sort of is a symbol for their life, a bird that they feel, you know, follows them physically in life and in their dreams. If you don't have that spiritual angle, there are people that, because of the scientifically proven intelligence of crows, just admire them and think that they're beautiful and glossy and wonderful to have around. And then on the other side of the spectrum, there's people that just hate crows, you know, just think that they are, you know, noisy, kind of the rat of the bird world, and also, again, find something that's not objective or scientific in their hatred of crows. There's a sense of darkness or foreboding or something disturbing about the crows that they can't put their finger on. There's very few people that are neutral about crows. And so that really started me, you know, looking into the world of crow stories and crow science, and I ended up having a great deal of fun writing that chapter. And then moving into the book had a lot to do, I think, with just recognizing that we're kind of stuck living in the city. And I'm a person that has always assumed that I would live a rural existence and, you know, raise my daughter out barefoot with cows in the field. And instead, we're here in Seattle and longing for sort of a connection with nature and feeling a melancholia about really living in the city when it's not what my vision for myself was. I really started turning to the close-to-home nature as a sense of cultivating that connection with the natural world on an everyday basis, and crows are perfect for that. So that's kind of a long answer to your question, but lots of threads led me into the world of crows.
Yeah, it's interesting in terms of what you were saying a little earlier on about, you know, they get such a bad rap, and I was thinking, I sort of thought of a correlation between the color black, you know, I mean, it's like, black cats get a bad rap. Black crows, if crows were red, would they, you know, or blue, would they, would people dislike them so much?
No, I think that you're absolutely right. I think that a lot of it has to do with that sort of cross-time and cross-cultural association with the color black and the presence of black shadowy creatures with death. And sort of the dark mysteries of the unknown. You know, it just has always represented for us in our art, in our literature, in our psyches, our myth, sort of that which we cannot know in a way that's unsettling to us. Mm-hmm. And so I think crows carry that into the landscape.
Hmm. In the book, one of the aspects I like is, well, I like all the examples you give of crows' intelligence, but I think you say their brains are as well put together as primates.
Right. It turns out that when we look at the behavior of crows are very social animals, and so they have, over time, developed what scientists call a cognitive toolbox that's very similar to the cognitive toolbox that groups of higher primates use. And so they use things like forethought, and imagination in determining their daily activities. So if you look at some other birds, and I have a great deal of respect for avian intelligence and consciousness, you know, across the spectrum of bird life, and scientists are really coming to understand that we've shortchanged birds in general, not just the corvid family that includes the crows and ravens and jays, but even things like hummingbirds and sparrows have a depth of consciousness that's beyond what we've typically ascribed to them. And so we're working on that. It's a very exciting new area of science. But even so, given that, you know, all these birds are intelligent in their way, if you compare a sparrow and its daily round of activities to that of a crow, there's a big difference in that the sparrow still relies a lot on stimulus response, on instinct. They have a much more limited repertoire of behaviors. But because crows are so smart, they can choose between, you know, a whole realm of behavioral responses to a given moment in their lives. And they can learn from past responses, they can learn from what they want to develop a creative response to something that's going on in their life. So they have this great plasticity of behavior. They kind of make up what they do as they go along, which not all birds have the intelligence to be able to do that. And so when we look outside and we see crows doing really interesting things and we think, you know, my goodness, you know, what is that crow doing? Crows must be, you know, very strange and smart. It's actually, we have these thoughts because it's true, because crows really are their lives are just unfolding in stories that are unique, and that, you know, we might be seeing a crow do something that that birds never do, that even crows rarely do. It just happens to be, you know, doing something in that moment. I mean, an example is, I give this example in the book. A friend called me and she said, Landa, this crow outside my window is stacking rocks. It's stacked. It's got a big rock in the bottom, and it's stacked a somewhat smaller flat stone on top of that, and it's working to get another stone on top of that one. And she paused and she said, is it making art? And she lives in downtown Seattle, close to the Seattle Art Museum Sculpture Garden, and thought that it might have gathered some inspiration from the Sculpture Museum. So, you know, and I can't put it past the crow. I don't know what the crow was doing. Who knows why this crow was stacking rocks? So we see, you know, we know that there's all kinds of things going on in the crow mind, and we just don't know exactly what they are. But mm-hmm. we know that they're worth watching and thinking about.
Well, this would be a great time for you to read. And if you just tuned in, you're listening to Writers on Writing on 88.9 KUCI FM in Irvine. And Leonda Lynn Haupt is about to read from Crow Planet, Essential Wisdom from the Urban Wilderness.
Yeah, so I don't think this section needs much setting up. I do refer to my unstable mind, and that is, as I mentioned earlier, that when I moved into this house in the city, I fell into kind of a period of melancholia about living in the city, and that's what that refers to.
Okay.
One morning, I was sitting at my desk writing before anyone else was up. I looked out to see a crow on top of the utility pole in front of our house with an oddly shaped something beneath its feet. I lifted my binoculars and couldn't believe my eyes. That crow had a bat. He was trying to eat the bat, but was clearly unnerved by the process. The elastic patagia of the bat's wings were unruly and kept snapping out from under the crow's feet. As soon as one part of the bat was under control, another part would escape, flopping askew. The bird kept shaking his head and wiping his bill as if the bat were unsettlingly sticky. I smiled. Here was one dark, misunderstood animal eating another. But then I scowled. I am a bat lover, one of the first things I did in order to begin the reconciliation of my urban wild house with my still unstable mind was to install a bat box beneath the east-facing eaves. Every evening, I kept my eye on the bat box's egress. I scanned the dusk and sky for signs of their small, erratic flight. And I had begun to conclude, reluctantly, that there must be no bats in our new neighborhood. Now this. Not only could I see plainly that there were bats among us after all, but I was reminded afresh of one of the crow's most contradictory purposes in my biological education. In their bold visibility, crows show me what I don't see. After the crow flew away, messy billed and bat in tow, I tiptoed out on the dewy grass to see whether there were any bits of bat left beneath the pole. I found a few tiny fluffs of gray-brown fur, soft as a chinchilla's. Had I not seen the crow with the bat, I am sure I would never have noticed these tiny bat clues. Attempting to read crow lives attunes my eyes to this quieter penciled world, its stories, its struggles, its needs. It inspires me to watch for the next layer and then the next. In our urban watching, we learn to remain alert to the presence of the wild on earth, to grow an awareness that is an essential counterbalance to the isolating loss of wild knowledge that urban and suburban living so typically brings. And I'll end with just this little anecdote.
Okay.
We heard the Indigo Girls play an outdoor concert at the zoo last summer. It was the end of the season, and the crows were beginning to gather in the numbers that would characterize their great autumn flocks swirling in the dusk. There were enough of them to make people start looking skyward, pointing, and to make those with the common sub-rational crow fear start feeling edgy. A few songs into the first set, about 20 crows settled in a tree at the edge of the field, and every one of them sat there quietly, with toes and faces pointed toward the stage. Were they enjoying the music? At the break, the crows flew off, but they returned when the girls came back on stage and started the second set. I watched the three on the front row branch. Were they... I can hardly suggest it, and it was barely perceptible. were they nodding their heads in time? And the word from the song, if the world is night, shine my life like a light.
That's great. That was Leonda Lynn Halp reading from Crow Planet, Essential Wisdom from the Urban Wilderness, published in hardcover by Little Brown. And did Little Brown do the paperback as well?
Yes, their paperback imprint is Back Bay Books.
Okay. I love this book. I tend to really appreciate books that have to do with science, but that are written in I don't know, more of a maybe narrative nonfiction style, or even the style of a memoir or such. And you really include yourself in this book a lot, and I love that about it. I wanted to ask you too about, since you are living in Seattle and you're living in an urban environment, I think there's the misconception that you have to be in the country to experience nature. But how can you bring nature into your own urban backyard?
Right. Well, that's the subject that I'm really passionate about. Barbara, we're living in a time, this decade that we're in is the first time in the history of the earth that the majority of people on the earth live in an urban setting rather than rural. Mm-hmm. And not only are we living in this urban settings, but we're living in these settings in a time when our lives are increasingly dominated by a technological interface, right? And we're mm-hmm. on our devices constantly. So not only are we actually sort of literally separated from wild places, but all of that lends us to sort of solidify in our minds the idea that we live lives separate from nature. And that in order to experience nature, we have to, you know, get in the car and drive out of the city and go to someplace wild. And I think experiences like that are extremely important. I think we have to get out of the city sometimes. But I also think that it's so important to cultivate a sense of our continuity with the more than human world, the natural wild world in our everyday life. And I think that the best way to do that is to, we can do that on a daily basis in the places that we live. And I'm working on a book now that really helps us to sort of pay attention to the close-to-home wild, the many urban wild creatures that make their homes among us. Sometimes we see them, but we don't pay much attention, and so we don't understand the depth to which, you know, their presences can be interesting, can be inspiring, the depth to which our lives are really intertwined, that we really live in the same community and we're kind of using the same places as homes. So I'm working on a book that's beyond crows and to explore the close-to-home wild.
Well, I want you back on the show when that comes out.
Well, I look forward to it. I'll just say, I haven't talked about it publicly much, but the working title is The Urban Bestiary, and it was inspired in part by the great medieval bestiaries, where in medieval times there were these great tomes that were the written content was generated by the philosophers and the scientists or watchers of nature of the time. But the books were penned and the images drawn by monks in the great medieval monasteries, and they were these, you know, ornate sort of gilded books penned on vellum. And what I love about the medieval bestiaries is that they combine not just observation and what was known as fact, but also myth, imagination, and things that were just sort of made up as probably true about these beasts. And it's all rolled into one, and you can't really tell which is which or which was believed to be which. And so I kind of draw on that in this new book, sort of bringing mythology, native mythology, ancient mythology, into our understanding of the science and observation of the animals we live with.
That sounds great. I love it. I love the title, too.
Thank you. That's a lot of fun.
Yeah. You know, we haven't really talked about writing exactly, and maybe just, you know, before we end, I wanted to ask you about writing your way out of a difficult place. I think a lot of us, I mean, I've gone through this. I'm in the last pages of a draft to a memoir, and as I think you know, and I find this one chapter just so difficult to write, and it's not because I, you know, feel it's so revealing or personal. It's just, it's difficult for some reason. I've really had to push through it and stay in the chair instead of going, you know, cleaning the house or mm-hmm. baking or, you know, knitting or weaving. And what sort of advice do you have for me and for everybody who finds themselves maybe in a difficult place in a work and, you know, differentiating between being bored and just needing to power through?
Oh, I know. It's so hard, isn't it? And I just have to, one of the things that you told me, because I was working on, I think earlier on in this book, when I first started and I was having trouble, I thought, this is my fourth book. It should be easier. And you said, it's never easier. I thought that is such good advice. I think it's really good for writers who are, earlier on in their writing life, to understand that these books do not spring fully formed, right? Or our ideas don't spring fully formed. It's this process that includes periods of real darkness is too strong a word, but just difficulty, at least. One of the things that I've noticed when I get into that avoidance of writing either a particular chapter or just a project in general is that, for me, identifying the issue as anxiety it's not that I'm blocked and the ideas aren't flowing. It's not that I'm bored. It's that I'm anxious about, I think, my ability, about comparing what I'm writing to things that I've written in the past, mm-hmm. about who's going to see it and how they're going to feel about it, and sometimes just... getting exercise and doing yoga and finding ways to do that in ways that aren't creating more avoidance. Like you said, cleaning the house, we can add doing yoga and going on a run to the list of ways that we procrastinate. But whatever works for me in terms of anxiety management, and then combined with, as you say, just sitting in the chair, turning on the timer for half an hour or whatever, and getting started, I think that is the best way to disseminate anxiety or disseminate blockage, is to just pick a very small period of time and open to the page that you're working on and continue going forward. And mm-hmm. it's just like running or something else that you don't want to do. As soon as you start doing it, you go, oh, I'm doing it, right? Mm-hmm. It's just not that bad.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's true. It's once you get going, it's allowing yourself to pick up that thread and just stay with it.
Yeah. It's hard. There's no easy answer, is there? I mean, we talk to one another about these things, and it's one of the questions, if I do readings, even if I'm doing readings, I'm not teaching a class, but I'm doing a reading on Crow Planet, it's what people want to know in the audience. Well, how do you keep writing, you know, when you're stuck? And you can see that they're asking for themselves and looking for that one magic thing that doesn't exist. Right?
Yeah. There's no replacement for sitting in the chair, is there?
There isn't. Sadly.
Hey, well, thank you so much for coming back on. And I want to tell everyone that you blog at thetangledness.com. I love your blog.
Thank you.
And I've subscribed. And I love getting your posts. And thank you so much. And great good luck with your new book.
Thank you, Barbara.
Okay. That was Leonda Lynn Hout. Her book is Crow Planet, published by Little Brown and Back Bay Books. Stay tuned for more here. Coming up in the second half, we'll have Kelly Sonak, a literary agent, with Andrea Brown. We're going to go into a PSA I should have played at the beginning, and then some music, so stay with us.
UC Irvine Health serves the Orange County community by providing its only school of medicine and its only university medical center. I'm Dr. Ralph Klayman, Dean of the UC Irvine School of Medicine. Our 500-plus UC Irvine physicians include more than 90 doctors in 15 disciplines who have been honored by their fellow physicians across the nation by being selected as Best Doctors in America. Our faculty provide advanced medical care and conduct groundbreaking clinical research both at Gottschalk Medical Plaza in Irvine and at UC Irvine Medical Center in Orange, the number one rated hospital in Orange County by U.S. News and World Report. At UC Irvine Health, our mission is discover, teach, heal. For more, please listen to one of our outstanding physicians in the following UC Irvine medical moment.
Did you know that on average every 40 seconds someone in the U.S. has a stroke? It's the third leading cause of death and the leading cause of serious long-term disability for Americans. I'm Dr. Vivek Jain, a neurologist and medical director of UC Irvine Healthcare's Stroke and Cerebrovascular Center. A stroke is a sudden interruption of blood supply to the brain caused by either a clot in an artery or a hemorrhage in the brain. Remember these symptoms: a sudden numbness of the face, arm, or leg, sudden trouble speaking, seeing, or walking, sudden confusion or loss of balance, or a severe headache. The symptoms depend on how severely and where the brain is affected, so people may have different symptoms and they could come and pass, or the symptoms can persist. But make no mistake, without blood, your brain cells are dying at an estimated rate of 2 million brain cells per minute. What's important to know is the faster you receive treatment for a stroke, the better your chances are not only for surviving, but also doing so with minimal disability. If you or someone you know experiences any of these symptoms, call 911. Don't wait. This is a medical emergency. Time is everything with stroke. Research shows that rapid treatment with clot-busting drugs or emergency surgery makes a huge difference in a patient's recovery. And thanks to UC Irvine's leadership, Orange County now has a pre-hospital system and a network of hospitals that serve as a designated stroke neurology receiving centers, a concept similar to trauma centers designed to quickly get stroke patients to the best hospitals for the best treatments. Strokes can occur at any age, but most happen in people 65 or older. High blood pressure is the most important risk factor, so remember, keep your blood pressure and cholesterol in check, don't smoke, stay active, and eat healthy, because the best way to treat stroke is to prevent one from happening in the first place.
At UC Irvine Health, tomorrow's healthcare happens today. Thank you for listening to this UC Irvine medical moment. For more information, please visit ucihealth.com or call toll-free 877-824-3627 or 877-UCI-DOCS. We are here for you.
Come back, baby, please don't go. No, I love you, darling, hate to see you go. Come back, baby, let's talk it over one more time. My heart's full of sorrow, mama aching tears. Gone 24 hours, child, seem like a thousand years. Come back, baby, let's talk it over one more time.
We are back with Writers on Writing on 88.9 FM KUCI, broadcasting from the University of California Irvine campus and on the web at KUCI.org and iTunes College Radio. I'm back with Kelly Sonak. She's a literary agent with the Andrea Brown Literary Agency, and she represents all types of children's literature. In picture books, Kelly looks for a good sense of humor, stories that stretch a young reader's imagination, and an authentic voice. and young adult and middle grade fiction. She appreciates literary voices and character-driven stories with heart, but is also drawn to light science fiction, well-crafted fantasy, and thrillers. You can find out more about her and the titles that she sold at AndreaBrownLit.com. Hi, Kelly.
Hi, Barbara. How are you?
Good, good. Great to talk to you again. For those who may not have heard you when you were on the show last, I think maybe it was 2 years ago.
It was a while ago.
Talk about how you came to be an agent and represent children's and young adult books.
Well, it's not really ever a straight path for literary agents, and mine wasn't either. I was very much interested in children's literature since I was young and up and through my teenage years and into my adult years. My mom was a kindergarten teacher, and she really had me in the classroom a lot, reading to the kids, and I was exposed to a lot of great literature as a child. And when I went to college, I studied English literature and took some children's lit classes on the side. And after school, got into publishing, but got into the academic side of things, working as an editor for very high-level science textbooks, and realizing that that wasn't where my heart was, even though I was working with some really cool people, took an opening, a entry-level opening at another agency here in San Diego, and learned that that was right for me, but knew I wanted to focus on children's literature, so moved over to Andrea Brown when I had that chance.
So, since you were on last, it seems there's always changes in publishing, but especially since, let's talk about since you began agenting, and then in the last 2 years, what sort of changes have you seen?
Well, before I became an agent really was when things in the children's literature world changed in such a big way. That was, you know, when we started to see the Harry Potter books really transformed the industry, and when Stephanie Meyer's came out with all of the Twilight books, we started to see a really robust growth in and focus on writing for children, and basically people were recognizing that this was a market that could make money. And so because of that, publishers have really put a lot of energy and I think pay more close attention to what works for kids, for teens and down. But certainly the YA industry is booming, and it has been since I've been working as an agent. Even though we're still in an economic downturn, the children's industry is quite strong, and I haven't seen the numbers for this past fiscal year, but in the past, the children's side of publishing has been making more than the adult side. And so we're just in a very good place in children's literature because of that.
So when you say, and when you say children's literature, are you talking about books for kids up to age, what, 18?
Yeah, basically up to 18. It's really just anything that's not considered adult literature, and I don't mean that as a dirty word. Anything that is really for somebody basically college and below or below college.
A friend of mine who religiously reads Publishers Lunch said that it seems that all the young adult novels that are selling are either paranormal, include vampires, or are dark in some way, maybe fit more in the horror genre. Do you find this to be true, and is it difficult to sell a somewhat normal teenage plot?
I don't find that to be true. We certainly saw a rise in paranormal when Twilight came out and everybody wanted their own vampire novel, but almost just as quickly we saw a shutdown from editors who were paranormaled out. You know, they really had seen too much of that. And you know, these waves come and go, and right now, because of Hunger Games, we're seeing a lot of dystopian literature, and almost just as quickly a lot of editors are saying that they already have their dystopian book. They don't want to see any more dystopian. So even though it might be on the rise in what's on the bookshelves, already the editors are tired of it. So those fluctuations can come and go, and I would certainly not say that it's easier to sell something that's paranormal these days. I think it's actually more difficult because the market is so crowded with it.
Yeah, I think it's interesting, too. It does seem that when there's a trend, writers, new writers hoping to get published or hoping to get an agent and sell a book kind of jump on the trend. And by the time there's a trend, it's probably too late to even jump on it.
You're absolutely right. But by the time you're going to get a contract, your book is, in a traditional cycle, going to be published 18 months after you sign on the dotted line. And by that point, the trend probably has already gone. So it's really hard to sort of jump on that moving bandwagon because it does move quite quickly.
Hmm. You're listening to Writers on Writing, KUCI-FM in Irvine. I'm with Kelly Sonak. She's a literary agent with the Andrea Brown Literary Agency. How do most of your clients come to you? Do they come mostly from referral? Do you get any out of the slush pile? How does that happen?
Probably most of my clients do come through regular means, which is by emailing me directly and sending a sample of their pages, and that's how all of us at the Andrea Brown Agency receive new submissions. However, I am often on the road traveling for conferences, and I do sometimes meet authors at conferences with whom I connect or I like their idea, and they might submit to me immediately. Or it might be several years after, and it just might be kind of a connection in the query. So it's kind of hard to know how many come through which means, but very many come through just the regular slush pile. So I do get quite a few that way.
So I got a question about query letters. Because a query letter is basically a business document, right? I mean, it's a letter, a business letter that a writer writes to you in hopes that you'll want to follow up and either see their manuscript or see a few chapters or whatever they have. How do you find that the voice of the writer comes through? Or are you not looking for voice in a query letter? Are you looking for story? Are you looking for plot? Are you looking for the writer of the query letter to basically have a sound, story about what they're going to send you?
It's kind of, it's a combination of all of those things. I'm mostly looking for professional and respectful email and letter that, courteously presents them to me and presents their story in kind of a concise and interesting way. And it's hard. The question about voice and query letter is difficult because it's true that, yes, if you are a humor writer, I would like to see, a little bit of wit in your words. However, I want that really reserved for the story. And above all, even if the query letter is mediocre, I'm going to scroll down to the writing sample and take a look at that just to make sure I'm not missing something, which doesn't mean you can't cheat and you still have to write a fantastic query letter. But I do, give the writer the benefit of the doubt and not... that's why you need an agent, is to present you and to pitch you, and that is my job from there on out. So I do want that letter to be professional and courteous and respectful, but I'm really going to be looking at the sample chapter to be swept off my feet.
Mm-hmm. And what about a writer's credentials? I mean, do you need to be impressed by something the writer has done, whether it be graduate school or working with a certain instructor or publications, journals, magazines, so forth?
The children's world is a little bit different than the adult world in the sense that platforms don't mean nearly as much. I don't think a teenager really cares if you've been in the New Yorker if you've won an award. However, there are certain things that do stand out to me, and so they're different than... If I was, looking for a writer of a cookbook, of course they would need to have an extensive platform in order for me to sell that to a food editor. In children's, I'm more interested in something like perhaps they've attended the Vermont College MFA program, which I hold in very high esteem, or perhaps they've gone to the Big Sur Writing Workshop, which our agency holds twice a year. Or perhaps they have critiqued with somebody else whom I'm familiar with and in the author circles. So those kind of connections are, might trigger some sort of interest in me as I'm reading, But really, again, it always comes down to the writing, and there are so many writers who I've taken on who have nothing under their belt, and it really doesn't mean anything negative.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. How closely, then, when you take somebody on, how closely do you work with them, excuse me, and their manuscript before you submit it? Do you, or do you like it to come in where it's, you know, it's pretty much ready to go?
I always love a clean manuscript. You know, I would always love to get something that I said, this doesn't need a lot of work. However, I have never submitted anything without first doing at least one editorial revision with my client. You know, I want to always make sure that the client has the best shot to get a really strong publishing deal and also to be one step closer to their successful published book. Not every editor edits the same. Some editors edit very little, and if they end up in an editor's hands like that, I want to still make sure that the book has the best chances of succeeding. So I usually will get my hands wet in the editorial process. More likely, it will be like 2 to 3 revisions before we're going out to editors, and sometimes it's much, much more. I have some manuscripts I've been working on for years, and I'm just sort of slowly helping the author let them evolve because they are these sort of bigger projects that I see a lot of promise for.
Mm-hmm. You are listening to Writers on Writing on KUCI FM in Irvine. I'm with Kelly Sonak, a literary agent with the Andrea Brown Literary Agency. What about picture books? Now, illustrations are so much part of picture books. When would you want to see illustrations, or do you not want to see them unless the artist or the writer is just top-notch?
I would only want to see illustrations if the person submitting is an illustrator. So if you are somebody who your strength is words, I don't want you to feel pressured to even give me a character representation of what you're imagining. I want to imagine that in my own head, and I have, you know, years of doing this and can play that film pretty well, and that's what I want you to do, is inspire a film in my own head, and that's what I want you to do for the editor, inspire the film in their head, and that then the editor, once they have acquired the project, will find an illustrator to illustrate that book for the author.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. What about, here's a scenario. Say you submit something to an editor, and the editor, for whatever reason, turns it down. Maybe it's not focused enough, or, you know, the editor likes the writing but says, I'm not sure about the story. The writer takes it back. You discuss it. The writer makes great revisions, takes a year to make revisions, say, or 6 months, or whatever it takes. The story now is much different. Would you submit it to the same editor, or do you get one shot, basically, when you submit to an editor? Or does it depend on how well you know the editor?
Yeah, it depends. It depends on how well I know the editor in the event that I know the editor is usually open to that kind of thing, or if I can call the editor and have a conversation about how it's changed, and I might send it back, but almost always I'm going to look back to their rejection and see if they had given some indication that the door was left open. Sometimes I'll get a response from an editor that says, I really liked this, but the ending wasn't satisfying enough to me. You know, thanks for your time. You know, best of luck. And if what we've done in the revision is change the ending so that it is much more satisfying and we feel like we have satisfied that editor, then we will go back specifically to them, letting them know how it's changed and why we think they should take another look.
Right. So if the editor seems to like it or does like the writing or really,
right,
you know, hasn't said, you know, this stinks, forget it, don't ever contact me.
Right. Right. And if they have just said, this isn't for me, you know, best of luck, then I don't think the door is open and we don't go back to that editor.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's interesting. Yeah, because I think, I don't know, new writers especially feel that, you know, you can just make a revision, even with an agent. You know, if an agent turns you down, you can, you know, revise your query or revise your manuscript and approach the agent again, which I would think is more difficult to do unless the agent does open the door and say, if you ever, you know, revise this, I'd be happy to see it again or send me something else.
Yeah, I think you're right. I mean, that's why the first impression is so important, and that's why I do editorial work with my clients before sending it out, so that, you know, we do have situations where either the door is left open or we're getting positive responses. And in terms of going to agents, I mean, our time is valuable as well as editors is. And, you know, we don't have all the time in the world to be looking at submissions, unfortunately. That's not the primary focus of our job. So unless something has been revised hugely and substantially, and we're talking, you know, maybe it's been a year since you've gone out with it the first time and you've gone to workshops and you've started working with a critique group and people really say this is hugely different, I would be careful about going back to the same people.
And I suppose if you did, then in that letter you would say, you know, in the year since I sent this to you, I've done such and such and this and that.
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah.
What about collaborations? Do you have any objection to writers collaborating and receiving a query from two writers or without even an illustrator involved?
I don't have any objections to it. I would always caution writers or writers and illustrators who decide to collaborate to ask themselves difficult questions before they begin submitting, that the most primary being if an editor or an agent likes one part of the project, the illustrations or the art or the chapters that are written in one of the voices, would you be willing to be split up? Because that very often becomes the case, you know, that there's interest in one side of it. And you do need to know, you know, what is the objective? Is the objective to always remain a team, or is the objective for one of you to get attention from an agent or editor?
I'm thinking, actually, of a recent novel that came out by Jay Asher and
Carolyn Mackler.
Yes, and you know how they came together and put out this novel. And I hardly hear of collaborations between writers in the young adult field.
Yeah, that was, you know, and I'm well informed on that because Jay Asher is one of my colleague's clients. So we're really excited about the future of us, and it's been doing really well. And that was a unique circumstance because both Jay and Carolyn were fairly well established and were both looking for their next story. And I don't know exactly how the idea came to be, but they began to write the story together and it was just clicking, which gets complicated because Carolyn is represented by another agent and has her own option publishers, and Jay has his agent and his own option publishers. So it gets a little tricky, but it worked out really well, and we ended up with a really great product, and that book is just soaring. So.
Well, in terms of agents within the same agency, would it ever happen that an agent within an agency might pass something on to another agent in the agency if it's not right for them, or would the agent feel that the writer didn't do his or her homework and should have sent it to the right agent to begin with?
No, we definitely share, and it might be the case that something comes to me and I have another author who I think writes with a similar voice, and so I think there would be too much overlap, and so I might send it to one of my colleagues, or I might have too much middle grade at the time, or, you know, my colleagues who are on maternity leave are sending their things to us. So, you know, we very much share at our agency. Not every agency is like that, so I can't speak for everyone, but our agency definitely does. If we see promise, but it's not quite right for us, we do share it. And as a matter of fact, I had just opened an email about a horror manuscript that one of my clients' colleagues got and wasn't right for her, and she's just passing it around to all of us to look at. So mm-hmm. We do that all the time.
Mm. How much might you read of a manuscript before you know whether or not it's for you? Would you read, would it make sense to read even a paragraph and go, you know what, I just am not going to like this? Or would that just not be enough? Would you have to read a chapter or the whole thing to know?
Sometimes I can just read several lines, and sometimes it's much, much more. I mean, I always hope that I get to the end before I've made that decision. You know, I always want to be reading further because I haven't made the decision to say no. So sometimes it's very easy for me to look at a manuscript, especially picture book manuscripts, which I sell a lot of, and see that it's something that I just can't sell because of the current market, or I have something like it, or it's too close to something else on the market or in the market right now. So sometimes it's very quick, and sometimes it takes the whole manuscript and then a couple days for me to think about it. So it depends.
It's been a while since I heard this line, but the line is agents are looking for a reason to say no. Is that at all accurate? I mean, or do you think it used to be accurate and now it's not, or is it just a myth, period?
I think the way I've just described going through a query, it might sound like that's what I do. I would say most agents are looking for a reason to fall in love. And even though many of us will say, oh, I can't do any more of this, or I have too many projects, I can't sign another client for a little while, we always break those rules, and we love breaking those rules because we love finding something that just totally tears us apart and puts us back together again, so that we just have to have that client. I'm working on something right now where I've just read a new submission and I'm just dying to represent this client, and I'm just really hoping that it works out. But I didn't think I had, the bandwidth at this moment, but I can't live without this project. So.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. I love it. And I appreciate you coming back on the show and talking about all this. It's so informative for our listeners. Thank you, Kelly.
Thank you. This was fun.
Thanks. It's Kelly Sonak, her agency. She's with the Andrea Brown Literary Agency, and you can find them online. And there's all kinds of information about the agency and how to submit your work. Do check it out. It's actually a beautiful website as well. Some agencies just have the best websites. Anyway, we're at the end of our time. If you're in Orange County next Tuesday night, check out T. Jefferson Parker. He's going to be a guest at the Pen on Fire Writers Salon. You can find out more if you go to my website, penonfire.com, and click on Writers Salon. There's a few seats left for that. Just a few, actually. And what else? The podcast. Some of you have been writing to me about our podcast. We've been having a bunch of trouble. I know the older podcasts before 2008 apparently are still accessible. If you go to writersonwriting.blogspot.com and in the search box enter a writer's last name or first name, and if we had them on the show, it'll come up. The newer podcasts since 2009 onward are more difficult, and I'm working with our server to get those working, and I hope it's soon. I really apologize for the frustration. I know some of you love getting the podcasts in your iTunes mailbox when we post them. And I apologize. I don't know what I can do except try to work it out. In any case, thank you so much for listening to Writers on Writing on 88.9 FM in Irvine. We'll talk to you next week.